Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. From the late 1950s to the late 1960s, Native American children were taken from their families and communities and sent to live with white families under what's known as the Indian Adoption Project. By 1972, the Association of Indian Affairs estimated that nearly a third of American Indian children had been placed with non-Native families. These forced removals and the racism and fractured identity that often came with them had devastating impacts on many of the adoptees. In 1978, the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed to protect them by requiring significant efforts to be made to keep children in Native communities. In her memoir, Bitterroot, today's guest, Susan Devan Harness, explores her own story as an American Indian transracial adoptee sent to live with a white couple. She illustrates the pervasive racism she and other Native Americans faced growing up in Montana in the early 1970s, as she retraces her journey to connect with her birth family and other transracial adoptees. Susan Devan Harness is a writer, lecturer, and oral historian, and has been a research associate for the Tri-Ethnic Center for Prevention Research at Colorado State University. She is a member of the Confederated Chehalis Kootenai Tribes, and she is author of Mixing Cultural Identities Through Transracial Adoption, Outcomes of the Indian Adoption Project, 1958 to 1967. Her new book is called Bitterroot, a Salish Memoir of Transracial Adoption. Hi, Susan. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Well, this book is really amazing. Thank you so much for writing this. The study that you authored about the outcome of the Indian Adoption Project was your MA research, and it involved gathering very sensitive and personal information from other people about their experiences. And we'll talk about that during today's show, because that was such an intense experience for you. Why did you ultimately decide to write this book and tell your own story?
Well, because in gathering the stories that I had done with for Mixing Cultural Identities, like you said, they were very powerful and they were at times very tragic and at times very sad. I just really felt like those weren't my stories to tell, even though I had been given permission by several of the people who participated. They really weren't my stories to tell. And I didn't want to fictionalize it, because at no time did I want people to say, well, she really dramatized this thing because she just wanted to make it more dramatic, because all of this is true. And it was really validating for me to talk with other adoptees and hear that truth given back to me.
You know, Susan, what was so amazing about your book is that the level of detail. I mean, it's almost like reading a novel, because we interview so many nonfiction authors on this show. And I really enjoyed reading this because of the detail. And I just wonder, I mean, in the first section, it takes place in Billings, Montana, May 1974. And I love how you went about writing this. You write, 2 months ago, I turned 15. How did you remember so much detail about your childhood?
I think a lot of course, like with any book, you don't write about every moment of your childhood. You write about those things that stick out the most. And so as I was moving through the writing of Bitterroot, these are memories that, for a variety of reasons, just really stuck out against all else. Either they were shaming, or they were enlightening, or they were life-changing. But if you take a look at it, it's portions of a story.
Right. And you also weave just a lot of Native history in the story, which you learned about later in life. So let's talk about your childhood. You were taken from your family when you were just 18 months old and adopted by a white couple at 2 years old. And your mom and dad seemed to be divided on how much connection to your past to allow you to have. On one hand, they told you as you were growing up that your parents died in a car crash. But on the other hand, your mom, your adoptive mom, declined to waive your tribal membership when an official asked her if she wanted to, acknowledging that those rights were not hers to give up, but yours. And we'll also talk about that. I'm sure a lot of people, you know, don't really know about the laws in place when it comes to white families asking their native kids if they wanted to give up their tribal membership. But let's just talk about what you were told as a child. What did your adoptive parents tell you about what happened to your family?
Well, basically what they told me is actually what Dr. Spock, the child-raising guru of the 1940s and 50s and 60s, said. And I had tracked down the edition, and of course I didn't write that information down, but I had tracked down the edition where he specifically says, adoption is created from such tragedy that children shouldn't be given the burden of knowing that information. So in order to stop the questions and stop the conversation, it's just best to tell them that their parents died. And so my parents were simply doing what a child-raising expert told them to do. My dad truly felt that was for the best. My mom later told me she always felt really uncomfortable lying about it.
Throughout the book, you're still searching for answers. I mean, even toward the end, you're still searching for answers. Can you tell us what you ultimately learned and how you got that information?
Well, what I ultimately learned is I learned that my parents, well, my mom was alive and living on the Flathead Indian Reservation at that time about 50 miles north of me. I was living in Missoula, Montana, and then I had asked a social worker up at Montana Social Services in Helena about if she could help me learn more about my family, and she really surreptitiously gave me that information by asking me into her office and having a file open with the information in it. And of course, it took me a long time to find it because as far as I was concerned, whatever was on her desk was none of my business. But it was eye-opening. It was absolutely eye-opening to find out that not only was my birth mother alive, but my siblings, all but one of my siblings was alive too. So well, at that time, all of my siblings were alive, and that I had eight of them.
Wow, eight siblings. How old were you when you found that file, Susan?
I was in my early 20s.
And in the book, you describe, you know, you were waiting for the social worker to come back to the office, and you see this file, and then you go through it and rush through it, and she basically says, "You cannot tell anyone that I gave you this information." How common is it for other adoptees to be lied to about their family and then have to fight so incredibly hard to get to the truth?
Well, it's really common because there's a lot of adoptees that I spoke to that had never been told they were adopted until they were well into adulthood. And a lot of them didn't even know that they were American Indian. They were told that they were Italian, or they were told that they were some other ethnicity. And I believe it's because just about anything is better than being Indian, especially out in the West. And so that part was common. And to get our records is unheard of. You can get non-identifying information, but I'll be honest, that's so not helpful. And the one thing that I really appreciated my mom saying is no one should know more about you than you. And so having those closed records really bothered her.
You also try to get numbers about the number of Native children placed with white families to force them to assimilate during the 1960s and the 1970s. At this point, what do we know? Do we have actual numbers?
We don't really. I just know that I had talked with one of the lawyers, one of the tribal lawyers that I was friends with, And I said, well, how many of us had been removed from the Flathead Indian Reservation? She said, we have no idea. She said, we didn't keep track the first 3 years. All we knew is that all of a sudden they seemed to be flying off the reservation. And she said, so we really don't know how many. And when I had contacted the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I've received no reply. So it's, you know, it's kind of one of those things where it wasn't a hard and fast policy. It was a handshake agreement to find out between the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Child Welfare League of America whether or not you could address the dysfunction on American Indian reservations by placing these kids in white homes, and whether or not the kids would thrive and how the families would thrive. And it was a 9-year study, and 3 years into the study, it was deemed to be really successful because children seemed to bond really well with their families and families seemed to bond really well with their kids. And at that point, the floodgates opened, and anybody who had anything to do with child placement got involved, whether it was state social services or Lutheran Family Services, Catholic Charities, you know, the Methodists, the Pentecostals, the Mormons, the Jews. It's just, we were really removed from the reservation at an astounding rate. And it's not just my reservation. It's most of the reservations out west.
The other question. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, in fact, I think there was probably no reservation that was untouched.
No reservation. The other questions that you raise in the book, and if you'd like, you can go into detail. I mean, you share so much personal information about your biological mom and what happened when you were 18 months old with Child Protective Services. And one of the questions that you ask is, you know, during the adoption process, did Child Protective Services reach out to other Native families? Can you talk more about that? I mean, when you talk to other transracial adoptees and doing your research, what did you learn, especially when Child Protective Services was involved? Did they reach out to other Native families?
For me, no. But, you know, they did reach out to some. For instance, one of my younger brother who was placed with American Indian tribal member. But for a big part of it, the placement was to address the dysfunction on the reservation, and that was high alcoholism rates and low, you know, reading rates and low graduation rates and economic issues. And of course, those don't exist in a vacuum. Those exist because of all the assimilation policies that have been put into place throughout history. And those assimilation policies were never to protect American Indians, regardless of how they might be worded. But they were really designed in order to fracture us and break us apart from one another. Because if you do that enough, then we just kind of dispel into the ether. And at that point, I think policymakers don't need to follow up with the treaty agreements, and they don't need to, you know, hold up their end of the agreement with the lands. And it sounds like a conspiracy theory. Excuse me. It sounds like a conspiracy theory. But the thing is if you start looking back throughout history, you start seeing a pattern to what's to be gained by non-natives, by assimilation policies.
Right. And when you think about the broken treaties, the colonization, the stealing of the land, placing tribes on land that, you know, does not have many resources, for example, I mean, there's so many layers to all of this, and it's directly connected to, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I wondered when I was reading about your biological mom and the problems that she had with alcohol, I was just thinking a lot about the history of her tribe and what her people had to go through and how that affected you directly because you were taken away from her from CPS and placed with a white family. Can you talk about that? I mean, there are many layers to all of this. When you talk about generational trauma, and I just wonder what you think about that.
Well, the generational trauma, I feel, is real. You know, our tribe didn't have it as bad as some of the other tribes. We had our issues. But if I look at that Manifest Destiny movement over the Great Plains, and you have all the tribes that exist from Minnesota all the way down to Texas as kind of the front of that front line, and you look at, you know, there were over 1,000 wars declared on American Indians in the United States from the U.S. Army. 1,000 wars. And you look at, especially as they move westward, they had a lot of those wars. And so you look at it, and it's like every few years, you're losing a good population of your young men, and you're losing a good population of your older men, and you're losing a good population of your elders and the people who keep everything intact. And you keep doing that generation after generation after generation, where the whole purpose of this was extinction, moving us towards extinction. You cannot come back from that brink of extinction unchanged. You just can't. And so what you're seeing in these cases of that quote unquote dysfunction are the markers of those wars towards extinction.
Today we're speaking with Susan Devan Harness about her new book, Bitterroot, a Salish memoir of transracial adoption. And if you have any questions or comments for Susan, if you are a transracial adoptee of any race, we'd love to hear from you. How have you defined your racial and cultural identity? Was a member of your family adopted? How was their heritage addressed or not during their childhood? And if you have any questions about Indian adoption, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. I want to ask you about what you endured in your household growing up with your adoptive parents. Racist stereotypes and outright hatred were a constant for you growing up, even in your own home. Your adoptive father was prone to outbursts. Some of them were violent. He was an alcoholic. And you write about the comments he made about Native Americans. You write about listening to a broadcast about the American Indian movement, and he was ridiculing them with slurs suggesting that Natives are drunks and crazy. I mean, this came from your own dad. Can you talk more about that and what that was like for you?
I think to be clear, back in the days that I'm talking, in the 1970s, racism in Montana, and racism in Montana still, is such a given, especially against American Indians. And there are 7 Indian reservations, and everybody has a story, and those stories are negative. And it's just, it saturates the social environment. Racism saturates a social environment to the point where it entered my home with absolutely no questions. And I think it's interesting because Dad never thought that he was saying anything wrong, because there were so many people like him that were saying the exact same thing. And I'd heard it the entire time that I was growing up and into my young adulthood and into my 20s. And I mean, I was well aware of how white Montanans thought about American Indians. They never held back that perception. And all you want to do is, I mean, this is where you live and you could address it, but you're either going to get beat up or you were going to be ostracized. And because we're only 2%, you know, we're 1.5 to 2% of the population. So it's not like any school I went to had a very large American Indian population. So it's not like I had backup. So it was, those assimilation projects worked very well on fragmenting my identity. And it took me a long time to fully appreciate the fact that I am who I am. I am an American Indian woman who was raised in a white family, and that's as good as it's going to get, and be accepting of whatever that has brought to me, because otherwise I'm just going to be angry like all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a caller who has a question about the American Indian movement. So let's hear from Brad in San Francisco. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. You're always out front, Rose. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I've questioned this, and I'm sorry I haven't had the time working so hard to actually probably study as deeply as I should. As to what exactly happened to the American Indian movement? It was looking so progressive in the late 70s, early 80s. It was a major topic. It looked like there was some real development moving forward, and it just died on the vine. Is it just flat out guilt and not being able to face what happened and what is happening? Or can you give me some insight into that, please? I think it's important.
Well, I appreciate your question. And unfortunately, the American Indian movement is not my specialty. But I will say that I believe it died on the vine, because after Wounded Knee, you know, if you look at the tapes of Wounded Knee, my gosh, they brought in tanks and they brought in fighter jets to deal with what was going on in Wounded Knee. And what you begin to realize is there is a social memory that we are enemies of the state because we fought to keep our land. And as enemies of the state, we are still in a lot of a tenuous place, because we aren't going to give up that land, and we aren't going to give up our treaty rights, and we're not going to give up that stuff. We're not going to give it up. You know, it'll have to be taken from us. And so what's the best way on social memory of making sure that people lose whatever power they have? You label them. You label them as drunks, and you label them as alcoholics, and you label them as people who can't take care of their children, and you label them as lazy. And that's what keeps them down at the bottom of the social hierarchy. And that way they don't become as much of a threat as people realize that they might be. Does that make sense?
Yes. I appreciate your response. It's your insight, and I'm grateful I was able to hear it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. And if you'd like to give us a call today, we're speaking with Susan Devan Harness about her book, Bitter Root, A Salish Memoir of Transracial Adoption. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you are in the Denver area, is that right? Susan, you'll be giving a TED Talk on June 22nd, and that's in Denver?
I will. Yes,
that's
it's
great.
Going to be at the Buell Theater.
All right, thank you. And you're also...
I was going to say, I should clarify, it's a TEDx Mile High, so it's
okay.
Not a TED Talk. So it's
okay.
It's more regional. They get test about that.
Oh, okay. Thank you. No, thank you. I didn't know that there was a difference. So Susan will be giving a TEDx talk in Denver on June 22nd, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after this.
Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Susan Devan Harness about her incredible book, Bitter Root, a Salish memoir of transracial adoption. Susan is a Native woman who was placed with a white couple at age 2, and she explores her search for answers to questions about race, identity, and family. She also chronicles her reconnection with her biological family and conversations with other transracial adoptees. And let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Greg in San Francisco. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, Susan. I'm calling because I'm a Lutheran, and I go to church regularly, and I've never heard anything from the pulpit or in any publication of theirs taking responsibility for separating Native children from their parents. Can you elaborate on the Lutheran Social Services responsibility for this?
Well, I appreciate your question. And I can't elaborate specifically on Lutheran Social Services, but I think with a lot of the religious movements, there is this idea of saving. And when the call was initially put out for the study, it was going to be the placement of 395 children, and they received 7,000 applications because the motto of the study was to save the poor, forgotten Indian child. And so I think during that time, there were a lot of people that felt that they were doing the right thing and doing the good thing. It's not until relatively recently that we've been able to have conversations, public conversations, about the real negative aspects of that information. I think there needs to be a lot of conversation within and among religious organizations about their role in actively separating children, as well as their role in not doing more to provide a pathway back to community. And I think with a lot of the separations, there is this attitude, and it's very much of a Western civilization attitude of, you own kids. These are my kids. You're not going to tell me how to raise my kids. And without really understanding that the kids belong to community, and they had a community before they were placed, and they should still be part of that community. And to what degree can be decided on as they get older. But I think that's the conversation that should be part of placement among all institutions.
Susan, can you tell us more about all of the work that you've done around transracial adoption, which ultimately led to the book Mixing Cultural Identities Through Transracial Adoption, Outcomes of the Indian Adoption Project, 1958 to 1967. And you write pretty extensively in Bitterroot about how you went about it, contacting tribes, contacting schools. You did some interviews in person, some on the phone, and those were really difficult because you ask very personal questions along with issues around sexual trauma. I mean, you go really deep with people who were adopted.
Well, and so I appreciate you bringing that up because that was really the first time that anybody had really looked at American Indian transracial adoption outside of the realm of psychology or outside of the realm of social work. And within those, a lot of times you are dealing with the individual. And so therefore, it is the individual that has an identity crisis. And what I did for the study is I took the issue of American Indian transracial adoption out of psychology, and I placed it into cultural anthropology because I began to realize I'm not the one with the identity problem. You know, society is the one that has the identity problem with me because I'm not easily labeled. I don't fall into an ethnicity. I don't have all those stereotypes that or those characteristics that people feel I should have in order to be quote unquote real. But that's just how I felt. And so I really wanted to talk with other adoptees and find out what the experience was in order to make broader statements. And I would always tell them that I was going to be talking about really, really difficult subjects. And if they hadn't thought about this experience a lot, that, you know, if they haven't really processed it, that they should probably think twice before participating. Because I didn't want to bring up topics that they weren't ready to hear yet. And I did have a lot of people say, yeah, I'm not ready for this. And then the other part that I did is I would introduce my project, and I would introduce the why I felt the project was important, but I also wanted them to know that I was an adoptee. And I remember telling that to one of the participants who was just silent on the phone for a moment, and then she said, then you know what it's like. And her statement was so intense. And what I responded with was, I know what my experience was like, but I want to know your experience. And what I found out is, you know, there is a lot of stereotypes. There was a lot of racism. There was a lot of physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse. To the point where that information, nobody knew that information. Nobody had ever asked about that information before. And so even though this was a relatively small study, it was an exploratory study. The fact that one quarter of the people that I talked with said that they had experienced sexual abuse was absolutely huge.
Hmm. Can you talk more about that? What happened after that information came out?
So I'm not really sure what happened after that information came out. I know that I have received a lot of emails and a lot of correspondence and a lot of conversation with people about thank you for telling my story, because it takes a lot of strength to talk about these things. And depending on where we are in our lives, a lot of us don't have that strength. And I didn't have that strength for a long time. At some point, I was just done. I was done being on the accepting end of what people felt that I should be. And I was going to kind of set the record straight. But I think the thing with adoption that is a little bit disconcerting, well, actually, it's a lot disconcerting, is that idea that we have legally and socially that this child through adoption is just like your biological child. But the thing is that when they come of age, especially the young women, we all of a sudden have kind of an exoticness to us. And at that point, that's when the questions become, well, they're not really my child. And so you can get some really weird thought processes involved in stuff like that. And I think that that's probably one of the things to be for society to be really aware of is when it starts getting into real dysfunction of some of the mechanics behind that thinking.
Well, and speaking of the mechanics, why was there so little follow-up with Native children who were placed with white families? Because, I mean, in very simplistic terms, you were taken from a family with alcohol issues and you were placed in a family with alcohol issues. And racism. We haven't even talked about your adoptive mom very much, but she also had some very deep mental health issues. And I mean, at one point, a doctor learned that you were living on your own when you were in high school and really didn't do anything about it. I mean, the entire system seems to have really failed you and so many other Native children placed with white families. I mean, was this common that there was absolutely no follow-up to see how you were doing in your white family?
There was no follow-up, and that's, I feel, for a couple of reasons. The first reason is the overwhelming idea that whatever you got placed into was going to be far better than whatever you got removed from. Now, whether or not that's a true and correct and real statement is highly debatable. But there's, you know, we're back to that social hierarchy thing where, you know, you have white America that is, or even, you know, Western civilization that is at the top of the hierarchy, and they get to tell everybody below them where they belong. And that means that if, you know, there's this implication and explicit also that as an American Indian, you don't have any value. If you want value, then you need to move up to middle class or upper middle class white American lifestyle. And so therefore, if you got placed with the white family, you know, mission solved, like problem solved. And so there wasn't, you know, why would you check up on anybody? Because again, it was, you know, and I feel this is the other piece that I really want to make clear is you have policymakers that have, you know, they see a benefit from implementing these processes. And a lot of these benefits are not visible to the general public. But, you know, they issue the policy and it works its way down the food chain. And then you have the social workers that are making, you know, these house calls. They don't really fully understand or maybe even appreciate the strategy behind the policy. All they know is that they need to go into these homes and they need to make children safe. And so with a lot of the social workers, they truly believe that they are doing the right thing. A lot of the judges that are placing children, even today, with white families feel that they are doing the right thing because there is an underlying assumption that all of American Indian communities are dysfunctional, that there is no functioning body within American Indian communities. And that's just not the case. But, you know, that's what you hear about because that's where all the studies exist, you know, or studies in psychology and sociology and a lot of them really have to do with the dysfunction of the families, and I think we need to change that focus a little bit in order to strengthen the Indian Child Welfare Act again.
Today we're speaking with Susan Devan Harness about her book, Bitterroot, A Salish Memoir of Transracial Adoption. We're going to get to a few more calls, but I wanted to read from your book when you write about the studies that you conducted. You write, of the 25 adoptees who took part in the structured telephone survey, 11 experienced emotional abuse, 9 experienced verbal abuse, 8 experienced physical abuse, and 7 experienced sexual abuse. You write, I winced as I listened to those 7 adoptees say yes to each item, their voices growing softer until the last answer was given with just a whisper. One of the women on my committee, a Native lawyer who specializes in child sexual abuse cases, was stunned at the prevalence of sexual abuse. Why doesn't anyone know this? She asked, staring at the screen. You also write about the unstructured interviews you conducted with 9 adoptees, and you asked them to tell you everything they felt was important for you to know about their experience. You asked them to basically say some words American Indians used to describe themselves: proud, cultural, spiritual, family-oriented, and humorous. They described Euro-Americans as materialistic, privileged, greedy, and ambitious. Although few had cultural ties to the American Indian community, Native adoptees tended to side with American Indians, who they describe as poor, beautiful, proud, spiritual, and humorous, while describing Euro-Americans as rude, selfish, fearful, and greedy. The last description summed up our experiences in the white world, end quote. Susan, we talked a little bit about just the racism that you had to endure in your own household from your adopted father. You also just talk about what it was like you were attending Montana State University and you were visiting friends, and there were lots of jokes about a lot of different people, and someone eventually tells a racist Indian joke, which happened to you on a very regular basis. And so many times before you laughed, tried to fit in, but this time you actually had a major breakdown. What was it like for you to write about that and just kind of go back to that experience?
It was really good to write about it, because what I felt by revisiting that space is how far I had come from being that person. And that was the very beginning of that awareness of acknowledging such an intense feeling of discomfort. And I really wanted, I don't know if I've lost touch with the people involved, but I really wanted, if they ever read this, I really wanted them to know the power of their messages, that, you know, that you have the right to tell people to stop when they're doing something that makes you feel uncomfortable. And because we aren't, you know, a lot of us are not raised in families that really wanted to give us a lot of that power. I know I wasn't. I was told what to do, when to do it, how to do it, why to do it. And I mean, I was kind of under my dad's thumb the whole time. And by the time I went to college, I had like no boundaries whatsoever, because I hadn't ever learned how to establish boundaries. But then if you take a look at the larger society, if they're labeling you as sluts, if they're labeling you as lazy, if they're labeling you as stupid, it's not like you're going to be allowed to have boundaries there either.
We have a related call. Let's hear from Phil in San Francisco. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. So I'm a white American, and in 1976, I was a waiter in Glacier National Park, which joins the Blackfoot Nation. I believe that's how they call themselves. And we had a meeting. We had a meeting with a park ranger who first warned us against grizzly bears, and then he started talking about the Native Americans, and he said, stay away from these critters because they can be dangerous. And to the credit of my colleagues, one stood up and really called this man out and said, you know, these are not animals, they're people. But the thing that I found so shocking, this is a federal employee using this language. So I think that's all the comment I really have to make. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I have one story to add to that. In 2005, I took a road trip to ask people about politics and voting and things like that. And I was in Montana getting gas. And a couple guys said, where are you headed? And I said, Browning, which is at the foot of Glacier National Park. And they said, Browning? You need to drive through Browning. It's full of Indians and it's very dangerous. You do not want to stop in Browning. And Susan, I heard this all throughout Montana over the course of my trip, a couple weeks that I spent there.
And that doesn't surprise me. I'd heard so many things, like I said, from the family that I was raised in. My stepmom had worked at a fabric outlet in Billings, and she regularly talked to me about how, you know, the crow just come up and they just looked at the fabrics and they never buy anything. They're just taking up your time, and it's just, I would look at her and I would just think, wow, look at my face. who do you think I am? But I think what confuses people is, you know, I talk just like them. I dress like them. I have gone to school with them. I have learned the same Western history with them. And for all intents and purposes, that assimilation policy has tragically been so successful with me that I think a lot of people just kind of forget who I am and who I might actually represent.
Have you heard from other transracial adoptees, other Native people who were placed with white families? Have they read your book? Have they reached out to you?
Yeah, I've had a lot of people reach out to me, and probably one of the biggest comments that I get, the biggest comment that I get is, thank you for telling my story. I think it's just so important that we move this conversation from the shadows into the public arena, because it involves so many pieces of our culture. It involves who gets to be defined of being a good parent or a bad parent, or who gets to be defined as being ethnic, or who gets to be defined as having a lot of social or cultural capital. And how are we going to measure that? And adoption is kind of at the crux of, you know, American Indian transracial adoption, as well as other types of transracial adoption, is at the crux of all those questions that really come together in a really sometimes violent collision.
And then if you add to that just the fact that we don't really talk about the true history of this country, we don't really learn about it. I mean, lately there has been an amazing awakening. Standing Rock really changed so much about, you know, people are learning about treaties. Native Americans are writing books, so many more books, at least from what I've seen. There's a lot more, a few, but not as much as we need, more natives in the media. And I just wonder, you know, what your thoughts are on how you, because we talked earlier, just quickly, you talked about the anger and how you deal with that. And, you know, so many parts of this book just made me angry and wondered how you deal with it. You write in the Custer's Ghost section, colonization has done a hack job on Indigenous people. We've had our culture ripped out from under our legs, our traditions and knowledge replaced, our wealth of horses replaced by paper money that means only what someone in Washington says it means. As a result, Indians have a 600% higher mortality rate from tuberculosis, 510% higher mortality rate from alcoholism. So many of these statistics, we're killing ourselves and one another at appalling rates. Homicide rates, suicide rates are high. So how do you deal with that, with these statistics, the history, the adoption? I mean, this is a big question, but how do you deal with that anger?
I read a book.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the other piece that I didn't really get a chance to talk about is that the generation of high school students that are coming up through American Indian tribes is really an amazing generation, because they feel, you know, when I've talked with several of the young people, they look at their family not through rose-colored glasses, but through that lens of reality. And what they say is, I don't want that for me. But they don't say, I'm going to leave in order to not get that. They have a plan. They have a plan for changes, and they're getting heavily involved in community, and they're getting involved in education, and they're getting involved in early child care. There's a lot of volunteerism that's happening. So I think as we've come back from that brink of extinction, each generation is gathering strength from the previous generation. And I truly believe that. And so I look at it not so much with anger, but if we can have an honest conversation, that next generation is going to be able to learn so much about that, and they're going to really work to change their reality. That's what I truly believe.
Susan Devan Harness is author of Bitter Root, a Salish memoir of transracial adoption. And in the book, you will learn about the significance of Bitter Root, and you will also learn about what happened when Susan connected with her biological family. Susan is a writer, lecturer, and oral historian. Her last book is Mixing Cultural Identities Through Transracial Adoption, Outcomes of the Indian Adoption Project. It was such a pleasure to talk with you about your book, and thank you so much for writing it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being able to talk about this.
Thank you so much. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.